So good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon. Yeah, everybody awake? Yeah. I'm Dana Cole. I'm the Executive Director of the Hardwood Federation. I think a lot of you have seen me either here or in other places around the country before. It's great to be here. I'm glad Linda arranged for this gorgeous weather because I know it's been a cold and snowy and rainy year for a lot of us. Okay, good. Let me make sure I can get this going. Perfect. All right, I'm going to go through some of this pretty quickly, just kind of the introductory comments and slides that I have here. But the Hardwood Federation, as I think many of you in this room know, is the united voice of the hardwood industry in Washington, D.C., and we focus on public policy and public and federal legislation that impacts the hardwood business community. We were established in 2004. We were created by a number of hardwood executives that really realized the importance of having a single entity in Washington, D.C., monitoring legislation on a daily basis, working on it year in and year out to give some consistency to the message and to kind of make sure that there were was an education process in place that could continually work with Congress and with the various administrations that come and go about the hardwood industries and what's important. We currently have, actually we have 28 hardwood business organizations. We recently were joined by the Tennessee Forestry Association, which is terrific. And here's a list, which you can't read, but you can see it's a big, long list, and we're really proud of the number of associations and the wide variety of types of associations that we have joining with us. Because, again, the more voices we have joining with us in our message on Capitol Hill, the better and the more powerful we are. Some of the things that we do on Capitol Hill, and I know many of you have participated in various parts of this, we educate policymakers. Every day we talk to at least some members of Congress, some staff, some administration officials. We let them know what is on our agenda, what is worrying us, what we are thinking about, how they can help us, or in many cases, how they cannot hurt us. We monitor federal policy, which is an ongoing and very busy occupation. There's a lot of stuff that comes across our desk. You know, a lot of it won't necessarily be considered, but, you know, you never know when one of these bills can slip by, so we try to be very diligent and track what we can. We participate in the process by submitting comments on potential pieces of legislation. We testify before Congress. We educate members of the hardwood community so that they can communicate in their ways as well. We also network with allies beyond our Hardwood Federation members. This includes people like the National Alliance of Forest Owners, the American Forest and Paper Association, other groups that have the same or similar concerns as we do, because, once again, we want to make sure that we're communicating in as broad and as a powerful way as we can. And finally, we support our champions, which means that we take our Hardwood Federation pack, which I am raising money for, and I'll be back at a table later this afternoon and tonight, so please come and see me if you're interested in participating. But we take those dollars that you contribute from your personal funds, and we support members of Congress that support us in our initiatives. This means that we talk to people that vote with us, that support legislation that supports the industry, that work to defeat legislation that harms the industry, and also the people that are in leadership positions that can take issues that are of most concern to us and run them, you know, through the legislative process on Capitol Hill, which is sometimes quite difficult and a lengthy process. So what I really wanted to get into today was to talk a little bit about advocacy and why I think it's important and why I think everybody here in this audience should be a part of our advocacy efforts. Whether you do it at the federal level or whether you do it at your local level, it's really important to talk to people that are in positions to make rules, regulations, laws that impact your business. And it does happen at every level of government, be it your local community, you know, your city council that might put in a stop sign that helps or hurts your business, or a federal agency that's going to impose some environmental rules that may impact how many permits that your facility has to get. So some of the questions I get, you know, why does the Hardwood Federation, why does the hardwood industry even need an office in Washington, D.C.? You know, people in D.C. don't care about my business. Why should I even engage with them? You know, and then, you know, what I've been hearing more and more frequently is, you know, everything's a mess in D.C. Nothing is getting done. Everybody's at each other's throats. Why bother? Well, why bother The answer to that is, you know, we say this a lot at the Hardwood Federation. People have heard it if you've been to the fly-ins. If you're not at the table, you are on the menu. Because when you are involved in the policy process and you are talking about what concerns you and educating members of Congress that might not deal with the hardwood industry every day or even at all, it's important that they have that perspective when they go up into the chambers to take that vote. And if you're not at that table expressing your opinion and your thoughts and your concerns, someone is going to take your seat. And that someone that takes your seat is probably not going to be saying what you want them to be saying. They're probably, in fact, going to be saying exactly the opposite of what you want them to be saying. So, you know, to kind of jump on what John Smith and the rest of the panel this morning was talking about, really, when you have a Hardwood Federation up there talking about these issues every day, when you engage in the process wherever you feel comfortable engaging in the process, you're really managing your political risk. You know, you're taking the time to mitigate what somebody might think incorrectly about our businesses and to inform them about the right way to think about the business and the right way to manage those businesses at the federal policy level. And I have to say, you know, managing this risk, there's a lot of things that you have to think about. Just as John and the rest of the group was talking this morning, there's a lot of things that you have to take into consideration. You know, number one, there are 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives. And they are all up for re-election every 2 years. And when they are up for re-election, there can be lots of change. There can be lots of turnover. Power control of that House can change and does change. And it can change overnight. It can change on a Tuesday night in November every 2 years. Just some examples. In 1994, Bill Clinton lost 52 seats in the House, shifting the control to the Republicans. In 2010, Barack Obama lost 63 seats, shifting the House back to Republican control. And last year, in 2018, President Trump lost 43 Republican seats, moving it back to Democratic control. So that means every time that switch happens, different people, a different party has control over, you know, what pieces of legislation make it to the floor, how much staff is working for either side of the aisle. You know, it is a very important, it's a very powerful position to be in control of the House, and it can change in a heartbeat. So you have to be sure that you're there talking to the people regardless of who's in control, trying to either mitigate if there's going to be a group in that's not necessarily friendly to the business, or trying to move forward policy when you can. And then, you know, you go across the street to the other side of the Capitol building, and there are 100 members of the Senate, and a third of them are up for re-election every year. And the balance of power, it's a little bit tougher to change there, but it will change. Right now, the Republicans are in control. Who knows what's going to happen in 2 years? But you have to continually be working on, you know, on not only those members and not only working with those members in their offices every day, but you also have to think about the number of committees that are out there working on various issues that can impact you. In the House, there are 21 standing committees. That's 21 committees that exist all the time. And within those 21 committees, there are 104 subcommittees. So you've got people working at the staff level on 104 subcommittees and 21 standing committees. All of those people need to be talked to about it when they are dealing with issues that impact you. In the Senate, there are another 20 standing committees and 71 subcommittees. So there's a lot of potential touchstones where things can happen, and they will happen. And also, there's just a tremendous amount of legislation that's running through Washington, D.C. every day. In the last congressional session, between 2017 and 2018, 13,556 pieces of legislation and resolutions were introduced. 3% passed. About 443 pieces of legislation or resolutions passed. It's a pretty low percentage. But again, you got to figure out, what's the risk of one of those pieces of legislation that didn't get passed? How could it pass? How could it have passed? What needs to be done to make sure it doesn't get passed? And, you know, will it come back? Because pieces of legislation have a habit of coming back into the future. So really, you know, I think the biggest reason that we exist and the biggest reason you should be concerned about making sure that we continue to exist, or some form of this kind of a federation continues to exist, is to mitigate your political risk, which is always going to be happening, and it's always going to be continually changing. Just a couple of other things to keep in mind. Two things get members of Congress's attention, and my good friend Tiffany Smith is here, and I think she would agree with me. Voters, the number of voters that you represent or that you can bring into an office, and the number of jobs that are existing in a congressional district or in a state, that gets attention. When we walk in and we say there's, you know, 20, 30, 100, 150 jobs in somebody's district, or thousands of jobs in somebody's state, that gets attention, because every one of those people could potentially vote for that member of Congress that's sitting in the chair across from you. So when we do our fly-in, it's, you know, this is a little bit of an advertisement for the fly-in, but it's really important that as many of you as possible show up, and that we can talk to, and we can show them an example of a business owner that employs people, that pays wages, pays living wages in those districts, and that also, you know, has a ripple effect in within their community. And I know a couple of people have already mentioned today the economic impact study. That's why the economic impact study was so important, that we took that on and we actually made that happen. And it was kind of it's been a dream of mine to have it since I came into the Federation. And I'm so grateful to the HMA and the other associations that contributed to that project, because it's going to be so valuable to us when we go up on the Hill over the next few years to have that data to show how important the industry actually is on a national level as well as on a state level. And towards the end of my speech, I'll give you a few examples about how important that study actually is and what those numbers say. And then the last thing is that change in Washington, D.C. is really incremental. It takes years to get some things done, until it doesn't. And I'll use tax reform as an example. The last significant tax reform that took place 30 years ago. Now, people talked about it for the 30 years since that tax reform took place. They talked a lot about it, and, you know, almost every presidential candidate that came before the U.S. population in those 30 years said, I'm going to do tax reform. But it didn't happen until, I think, like 2 years ago. And then it happened incredibly quickly. You know, I remember sitting around thinking, you know, yeah, this is never going to happen. It hasn't happened in 30 years. This isn't going to happen. And it happened in about a year, I think a little bit over a year. So things can take forever, and they can be kind of floating around out there. But when they decide to move, they will move quickly. And you want to make sure that you've had the information, you know, flowing up into those offices and into those committee staffs, so that you kind of laid the groundwork and you don't have to rush up there at the last minute and try to meet as many people as you can and inform them about the issues that are impacting us. And this is why I say it's really important to maybe start thinking about talking to your local elected officials. Because what happens in politics is it's like any other business. Once you're in politics, you start moving up. So your local, you know, your mayor, your city council member could potentially eventually be a member of your state legislature, and then a member of your congressional delegation, and then who knows where they go. So, you know, think national, but also think local. You know, it moves up the chain. So, and I wanted to kind of give an example of a few things. We actually had some tremendous successes last year. You know, one of the things I said was people have this idea that nothing's getting done in Washington, D.C., but stuff is getting done. It's just not the stuff that's on, you know, Fox or MSNBC or CNN every day, because they're kind of concerned with their own issues that they like to talk about. But things happened last year. And one of the most important things that happened for this industry is we actually got some pretty significant positive change in federal forest management reform. There was a spending bill that was passed earlier in the year where there were a number of provisions included, including a solution to the fire borrowing issue. And I know a lot of you had heard me talk about fire borrowing before, but this was a situation in the U.S. Forest Service where they were actually kind of taking allocated money for programs that are important to us, you know, like timber harvest funding, like wildlife sustainability programs, like forest reclamation and forest maintenance programs. They were taking money for those programs because there were so many forest fires that they had to steal money, kind of like rob Peter to pay Paul. And it was such a terrible situation that they were spending over 50% of the U.S. forest budget to fight fires. Now, we can talk a lot about, well, maybe if they would actually manage their forests a little bit better, those forest fires would go down. But hopefully now that they've found some funding solutions to fight those fires without taking money from other programs, some of those management programs will actually get to take place. There were also some other fixes that were put into place, including streamlining NEPA, expanding the stewardship contract program and good neighbor authority, and also doing some improvements to road access. So a lot actually happened, but this was a long time coming. I know I've been standing up here talking to y'all for like 5 years about we're working on it. It's coming. It's getting there. Last year it finally came here, or we finally arrived where we wanted to be. And I will say that we're starting to see some real results in our efforts. For the first time since 1997, last year the Forest Service harvested over 3 billion board feet off the federal lands. They were just short of their goal of 3.4 billion board feet. They harvested 3.2 billion board feet, but they're getting there. And I know that's not nearly as nowhere near, I think it was 8 billion board feet that they used to do pre-2008, you know, earlier. But they're starting to make a comeback. And I think the leadership that they actually have at the Forest Service right now is very, very focused on getting these numbers even higher. But it took a long time to kind of get the right people in place, to get the right attitudes in Congress to make some of the changes that are making change possible. And it's taken a long time just to start rebuilding programs that were in existence years ago. Farm Bill reauthorization, another thing that takes time to move forward. The Farm Bill is reauthorized every 5 years. So we just got it reauthorized at the end of last year. The president signed it, I think, on December 21st. But, you know, I'll tell you, we're going to start in about 3 or 4 months. We're going to have to start talking to people again about the next reauthorization in 2023. Because it takes that long to make sure that the programs that impact us most continue to be included in the Farm Bill. And those programs are things like, of course, the funding for the export promotion programs, which AHEC runs. I have to say there's a lot of bipartisan support for those programs, but they always come under fire at some point. So we have to constantly be aware of who's saying what and making sure that we kind of nip anything at the bud that might come forward. But we were really happy... We were very, very pleased that full funding for the export promotion programs were included in the final version of the Farm Bill. Also, the Timber Innovation Act, which supports cross-laminated timber research and development, looking at how to increase the number of tall wood buildings that are being built. That was included as part of the Farm Bill. Right now, it's more of a softwood play, but I think, you know, with the work that I know HMA, NHLA, and HMI are doing to kind of figure out how we can incorporate hardwoods in that process, I think that somewhere down the road, we're going to be able to take advantage of this program. Also, Community Wood Energy and Innovation. This was a program to provide grants to local communities to get wood-burning heat sources installed in public buildings, a great way to kind of identify new uses for our residuals that we have from the industry. And then I'll quickly mention Waters of the U.S. This was a program, a rule change that was proposed by the Obama administration late in his final term. And, you know, this is one of those things that was trying to kind of get snuck through, and it didn't really work. It proposed that they actually change the definition of navigable waters to, you know, if you look out here, this is a navigable water. You see the big boats going by earlier today. Navigable waters are waters that you can, like, float things on. The rule change that was proposed by the Obama administration would have made temporary water flows navigable waters that had to be permitted under the Clean Water Act. So if you've got some forest land, if you've got crop lands, you have a big rain, you might get a little stream that kind of develops going through your property. This rule would have declared that as a navigable water and required permitting under the Clean Water Act, potentially. So the Trump administration has actually kind of reversed that and clarified that rule. So this is a navigable water, and some temporary stream is not a navigable water. So we were really pleased to see that. This probably wasn't necessarily a long-term project in terms of, like, the rule being introduced and then the revision being introduced, but what will take a long time are probably the court battles that will come about after this. It'll probably be in court for quite a while. once the rule is finalized, which I anticipate will happen at the end of the year. So just a quick look ahead. In 2019, these are some things that will be occupying our time. Trade, again, forest management, we're going to continue to work on that. I see a great potential for us to do a lot of work on endangered species and the Endangered Species Act, trying to bring some rationality to that act. I think the Department of the Interior is very interested in doing that. The administration is very interested in addressing some of these issues. And infrastructure could potentially be one area of agreement in the current congressional kind of split that we have. And the president's interested in doing it, and both sides of the aisle say they're interested in doing it. Whether they can come together and figure out a way to do it is kind of up in the air. But we'll be tracking that, especially around the issue of truck weights. So really quickly, I'm going to run through some numbers here from the Hardwood Economic Impact Study, because I think this is really it's really great news, and it's important for the industry. Again, you know, I think Linda mentioned earlier, we looked at the data revolving around jobs, gross domestic product, labor income, output, and taxes. And we worked with a firm that kind of took all of this the national data that they could find and came up with a formula that they kind of put all of it in, and then they came up with information from every state as well as national numbers. So your national numbers, overall, if you look at the industry and all of the ripple effects of the industry, it's about a $350 billion industry. If you look at just the direct effect, it's about $135 billion, and that's nationally. We're employing almost 2 million people as a total number, and almost 700,000 people directly. So these are big numbers. And then you start getting into and exports. They also looked at exports a bit, and I think a lot of folks know how important exports are, but 206,000 jobs, about $20 billion impact for the industry. So I just picked a couple of states here. All 50 states are on our website, so I encourage you to go and take a look. This is South Carolina, about $3.35 billion, 18,000 jobs. Pennsylvania, 63,000 jobs, and about $11 billion. Obviously one of our bigger states with one of the bigger economic impacts. But, again, think about going into a member of Congress's office from the state of Pennsylvania and laying this down in front of them. It's going to catch their attention pretty quickly. So, again, thank you to HMA for supporting us. Thank you to all the other organizations here. I'm probably going to forget, but I know NHLA is here. The Railroad Tie Association's here. AHMI is here. Wood Components Manufacturers. Linda, did I forget anybody else? I think so. But again, thank you very much for all this. The PLMA and Hardwood Manufacturer, the Hardwood Review also contributed. So I'll just leave you with this, and actually Linda sent this to me. It was like on a Sunday night or something. She sent this to me. But I think it's great, and I'm gonna close a lot of my speaking opportunities with this. If you do not take an interest in the affairs of your government, then you're doomed to live under the rule of fools. And you'll notice that this was a quote from Plato. So, you know, everybody thinks our government is all crazy and everything's going wild right now. Well, the government's been crazy since the time of Plato. So I remain optimistic that we will get through any preconceived craziness that's going on right now. But it's important for you to take an interest and to participate in that process if you want to avoid the rule of fools, as Plato so wisely pointed out. So in conclusion, thank you to HMA. I mean, thank you to so many of you that support our PAC and that support us through our corporate funds. Both are incredibly important to us, and we appreciate every penny, and I try to watch every penny very, very carefully. I'll be here through today and tomorrow morning. We are raffling off the flag for our PAC contributions, but I can also take corporate donations if anybody's interested. So please come by and chat with me. I'd be interested to hear what you are thinking and feeling about, you know, the current state of affairs in Washington, D.C. I can't promise I can do anything about it, but we are working hard to do everything we can. So I have time. Do I have time for a few questions, or do we need to? One question, Linda said. Claire?
Do you have, speaking of benchmarking, where do we benchmark in our size
In terms of? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question. I'll have to look into that. That I don't know. I mean, we're fairly significant, I think, if you take the big look. And I've heard some numbers that if you look, we're actually bigger than automotive and chemical, just because we get into such small local communities. But I haven't been able to confirm that. But I have heard that tossed around. Okay. All right, great. I'll be around. So come and see me.